Hello, and welcome to the IDEA podcast series, Best Practices in District Energy. I'm Rob Thornton, President and CEO of the International District Energy Association. This podcast platform is brought to you with the support of the U.S. Department of Energy, Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy, and the Industrial Efficiency and Decarbonization Office. As many of you know, IDEA members own and operate district energy systems in cities, on campuses, and communities across North America and around the world. And since our founding in 1909, IDEA has been committed to informing, connecting, and advancing the district energy industry. So, as industries, governments, and citizens look for solutions that can be deployed right now to improve efficiency, enhance resilience, and reduce emissions, on this podcast platform, our aim is to explore those innovations, technologies, and best practices that can accelerate our path to a lower carbon economy. Thank you for joining us, and I hope you enjoy this podcast.
Hello and welcome. My name is Henry Johnstone, mechanical engineer with some experience in evaluation, modeling, design, commissioning of district energy systems around the country. For the last couple of years, I've been working with IDEA as a technical advisor on their grant with the Department of Energy, identifying best practices in district energy systems. Today, we're talking with some folks from the University of Minnesota who kind of floated up out of the best practice exercise as really having some very interesting ideas and ways of doing things. So this will be an interesting conversation to talk about the best practices at the University of Minnesota. Well, maybe we could just start off. Could you each introduce yourself and what it is you do for the university, the utility system?
Certainly. I'm Jeff Davis. I'm the Director for Energy Management and kind of oversee utility operations and energy efficiency and energy conservation projects.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm Jim Kuchever. I'm the Assistant General Manager for Utility Operations, so relatively new to the university. I started here in March of 23. But career electric and gas utility and energy management guy. I manage the operation of our three plant facilities and then our distribution system with steam, chilled water, and electrical distribution as well.
Yeah. And how long you say you've been there?
Since March of 23, so not even a
Oh,
year.
yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you haven't actually gone through a winter yet.
Well, so born and raised in northern Minnesota.
Okay.
So I started with Northern States Power Company and then managed a municipal with a cogen facility and district heating system in northern Minnesota. So I've been
Cogen.
climatized.
Yeah. Right. Good. Good. And Scott?
Scott McCord, I'm lead mechanical engineer with the organization. We support all utility operations, plants, distributed chilled water controls. You name it. So we gotta fix
Yeah.
it, we gotta build it. That's kind of my team.
Sure. Have you been there a while?
I've been at the U since let's see, 2004. I started as an intern in 2004 and been full time
Wow.
here since 2005. So I've seen
Huh?
a lot of the changes and iterations here over the
Yeah.
last couple decades. So
Yeah. That's
very
pretty cool.
happy to.
Started as an intern. Now you're the lead. That's pretty cool.
It is. And good for us. Yeah, good for us. Lots of
Good.
corporate knowledge.
Right. Well, I'm just gonna let's just talk through some of these questions here and what we're really trying to accomplish is I think after we got done with our survey of 30 or 40 different sites, we kind of reflected on those sites that seemed like they had the most going on, really good best practices, systems that are kind of stand out, at least in our minds, as exemplary. And it sure seemed like you guys had some pretty cool stuff going on. So at any time here, just fill in the blanks. Let us know what you do. I mean, the goal of this really is to share knowledge with other, you know, sister universities, other district energy systems around the country. So, yeah, we're just trying to get an idea, not just the engineering aspects of it, but some of the management stuff and the way, you know, the way you've handled financing and operations as well. So maybe we could just start out just talking a bit about the scope of your system here. It really struck us as this is a very large system. It's got multiple plants. In fact, it's got a river going between it. Can you just give us a brief overview of what it is you do and what the locale is like?
You want me to chime in?
Sure.
So, you know, Twin Cities here, kind of what we say is it's like an 80,000 person city, right? We've got a large undergraduate, large graduate school, huge staff and academics on campus. And of course, you know, with hospital and research on campus, there's a lot of people that join this campus every day. So that's kind of what it is. There's a hospital on campus, med school, river running right through it. We've got a farm on this campus as well on our St. Paul side. So, I mean, we kind of cover it all.
Yeah.
You know, from a system standpoint, you know, we've got the three steam plants, three energy plants. Two of them with power gen, as we mentioned, and one of those has cooling generation. We will commission next year. You know, we've got 17 distributed chill water plants serving that campus. Five geographic districts, obviously, with how spread out we are over the Mississippi River. Light rail running through the middle of campus. You name it, right? And then, you know, it gets cold, but as well as hot, right? It's very humid in the summer. We're kind of a swamp in Minnesota, so yeah, we skate in the winter and we swat mosquitoes in the summer. So, you know, the overall system, you know, Minneapolis is a 530,000 pound per hour peak load. St. Paul's 140, so a fairly large as far as campuses go.
Yeah,
you know, about 35,000 ton peak on Minneapolis, 7,000 in St. Paul, and overall with both campuses, we're about 70 megawatts. So,
70
you know,
megs.
Uh-huh. 70 megs.
So on up, and that peak happens in the summertime.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, those peak human days. You know, it's a big research campus, right? So, you know, we're primarily conditioning outside air, you know, for our research facilities and hospitals and whatnot. So. Very high peaks with those high human days.
Yeah. So you got multiple plants and multiple distribution systems. Do you run them that way, or is it sort of like a, you know, central operation to take care of everything?
Well, it depends on which system you're talking about. Uh-huh. So for steam, it's definitely three. Well, we have the main campus is supplied by the CHP, the gas turbine CHP plant, mm-hmm. and then the southeast plant, which is package boilers and a CFB. Generally, our southeast plant is in operation from November through March.
Okay.
Because otherwise the main energy plant can handle the steam load. So they're operated, you know, the main energy plant is the baseline plant. We run that full on, full out all the time.
Yeah.
Well, 90% of the time. And then we augment steam with the southeast plant. The St. Paul plant St. Paul campus is about a 5 mile separated from the main campus.
Yeah.
And so that has its own independent steam system.
Yeah.
And then the chill water, I'll let Scott talk about chill water. I still haven't figured that one out.
I don't remember most of it. So no, it's we're geographically distributed on campus. Campus never really had a central system. They had and then they built a bunch of satellite facilities, and over the last couple of decades we've been basically assembling a distributed central system out of that through, you know, as opportunities arose, capitalized stranded assets and all that. So it's now only five geographic systems.
Okay.
and with these interconnected 17 plants. It's all autonomous. So we have a common control background, common control scheme my team maintains. And we have a dedicated staff maintaining those and running those facilities. And they operate year-round. And it's not how you would draw it up from scratch. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. But we made the best of what we had, and we built upon it, and we'll continue to make it better.
Yeah.
You know, as we need to replace equipment, make upgrades, remodel campus, and expand.
So you got distribution piping connecting these multiple smaller scale chiller plants.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yep.
And you're able to the autonomous part is pretty cool. So you're able to sort of remotely sequence and start and stop and stage chillers and that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything, you know, the distributed fleet is primarily, you know, electric driven chillers. There's a handful of absorption chillers, but we have a dispatch model for that. And yeah, it's all, you know, local basically controls and custom programming that we've written. That takes care of staging up, staging down, optimizing all the plant parasitics, you name it, to, you know, run what we have as efficiently as you know, it can. So,
Henry, Jeff had talked about the, two plants in the Minneapolis campus that feed our steam distribution system.
Yeah.
That distribution system, it's really a decent system. We've got about 14 miles of underground tunnel that we, I'll say, run a typical district heating system, steam system through, very well kept. It's a really well done system, including full condensate return. So we do return probably 97% of our condensate back to those two plants. So very similar on a smaller scale in St. Paul. Again, underground tunnel distribution system. And again, it's being new here. You know, again, I came in March, and it's enviable. You know, it's a very, very well kept, very well done system.
Yeah, 90%+ is tight compared to many of these universities we talk to are substantially less than that. So you must do a lot of maintenance and keep the traps and the drips and all that stuff tight.
We do, and we're very proud of our crews. You know, it's a talented leadership team. It's a talented trades group that just man those systems year-round. And, again, they're pretty tight.
Yeah. Okay, we'll come back to that. Let me move on a little bit. So now we got this picture of a very large distributed, distributed across acres and multiple buildings. Big system here with a lot of moving parts. And I'd like to just talk a little bit about your planning process. One of the things we picked up on, I think maybe the last interview, but we certainly dug it up, was a utility master plan that kind of looked at how these systems were going to react to planned growth in the hospital and a bunch of aging infrastructure problems. Is that something you're actively doing? Is that kind of an ongoing, we're planning while we're operating kind of a thing?
It is. The article that you guys wrote about us several years ago. Our current main energy plant, the CHP plant, was kind of, we undertook a utility master plan in 2008. And through that plan, identified that we were going to run, we had a steam, we were going to run short of steam.
Yeah.
So for heat. So we kind of, and again, Scott could probably add more to this since he was more intimately involved in the selection and processes. But as I was not here at the time, we needed steam, and it was like, well, do we build more boilers? Do we add more boilers? What do we do? Through a lot of analysis came out, well, we're going to, it would be more financially economical to to build a CHP plant. We'll get the steam we want, then we get the electricity, we save on our electric costs, so we're not buying all our electricity from the local utility. And that's what we did. The study was, 2008 to 2010. We made the decision that we were going to build a new plant, did some more studying to figure out how we were going to configure the plant, whether it was, one turbine or two, how big. I think started the process in about 2013, and the plant was online in 2016. Early 2017. Uh-huh. And it's really worked out very well for us. We've since just added a 6,000 ton chiller plant into the main energy plant, which we're hoping to have commissioned this summer, but due to some delays in the electrical, trying to get electrical gear, we'll be commissioning it this coming spring. Then the next step, we're right now just kicking off our next energy and utility plan. Mm-hmm. And kind of to your question on that you had forwarded, we were looking some of the big thing. We've got campus started out with the, it's kind of systematically a campus plan that was laid out on kind of where they think campus is going to grow, where we're going to build new buildings, what's coming down. So we got the campus plan, then we went after climate action plan. So how are we going to, not only are we going to build, but how are we going to, end up at zero carbon at some point in the future?
Yeah.
And then now we're laying out the energy and utility plan. So slightly different than traditional utility plan, where we're just trying to figure out how to supply everything. With this plan, hopefully we'll be looking at, not only the supply, but heavy on the demand reduction side as well.
Let's talk about that. But first, would you say the big investment in CodeGen came out of that study? That I'm imagining that's all been a pretty good deal over the ensuing years here, just given the, sort of the way the electric industry has evolved and natural gas has been relatively stable. Is that true? CodeGen's really paid off?
CodeGen has paid off hugely. If you think back to 2010, 11, when the modeling was done for the costing, gas prices were quite a bit higher than they are today.
Yeah.
And back then the payback was about 12 years on the difference. Yeah. And the big factor was electrical costs, that was what was going to be the big electrical. So not only have gas prices gone down and stayed down for the most part, but the electrical costs did go up and are continuing to go up. So it just makes it better and better.
Yeah. That's great. The economic modeling done as that part of the planning, not only, you not only met that, you probably beat that and it's better return than anticipated.
We did.
Yeah. And I guess we were kind of impressed. It's an LM2500. It's pretty much of an industrial, almost a utility type of machine you got there, with a fired HRSG. I mean, it seems like you really thought through the right configuration of the CodeGen for your load. What kind of process did you go through to kind of, pick and choose among the options for turbines?
This effort went through a bunch of different options, different configurations before we kind of landed on what you kind of see there today, which is a base, LM2500 dual fuel unit. With the high gas prices, there was a lot of question back in the day whether we should just put another boiler in because it's cheaper, right?
Yeah.
And it just intuitively, it didn't make a whole lot of sense. We just continued to restudy it and look at the long-term economics, and it had support from an administration to, kind of plow ahead with a CHP plant. It originally was 2 7.5 megawatt dual fuel units, right? But once we had our permanent design team on board, we did go through a right sizing exercise looking at heat loads, electric loads. Electric system on campus is a little different beast. This is kind of big for what we're told for the power level we're dealing with here with our configuration. So it was a little bit of a lot of wrenching, a lot of creativity on electrical side of how that was going to happen to settle in on this unit. So, you know, it wasn't just, you know, the mechanical guy saying, yeah, this is the perfect solution. It fits so great here because that part was easy. It was really, you know, bringing the whole team together and our power guys and getting them settled down and being very creative and figuring how we're going to land it on campus.
Yeah. I think that one of the big things is we looked at, you know, what would it be the base load for electrical? Mm-hmm. You know, we looked at a lot of different things. We knew how much steam we needed, and steam wasn't that difficult to come up with. But it was the base load on electrical. So, you know, in the winter, you know, like we're winter break right now, our load on campus is going to be right about 22 megawatts, which is,
you know,
well, okay. You know, coincidentally, that's what our generator is, but maybe not so coincidentally. So the plan was to you know, find the base load generator, drive that, and then, you know, between that and the Hersig, we could get the steam we needed. Yeah. And as it turned out, you know, it's worked out, you know, almost, you know, perfectly. You know, we run that plant flat out, you know, 365, well, without, you know, a couple maintenance periods, but we run the plant flat out at 22 megawatts. And whether it's just waste heat in the summer making steam or we're firing the Hersig, we generally, that will cover our requirements.
Yeah.
And then we just have the Southeast plant in, you know, standby as the peaking plant, as it were. Now in the winter it peaks from, like I said, November through March, but the other plant that's how the decision was made. It was we're gonna use it, let's use everything, every bit of it, and then we'll add on top of it.
And so you don't have any interconnect issues with the local utility there. You're basically, everything you're doing is more or less behind the meter, so to say.
Exactly. And that was part of the deal too, because that the economics change drastically when you start feeding back.
You know, is the local utilities stressed in any way? Are there times when they would say, wish you guys had more power?
No, they were
they don't like this project.
They were not a real big fan of the project, because obviously that's a fairly substantial, you know, hit to them.
Sure.
No, for the electrical side, I think that the city is in pretty good shape. They don't, Excel. I mean, they same challenges most places do. They're going to have to upgrade and increase their capacity as everybody else, you know, moves towards electrification. But in general, that was not a problem for the campus.
Yeah.
Or I think the immediate vicinity.
Yeah.
You know, our issue is, like most, you know, on the gas side, you know, we'll occasionally get curtailed depending on, you know, how that goes. So the dual fuel was critical. And so having the fuel, you know, switch over to fuel oil, you know, we were able to, you know, the big polar vortex thing a couple years ago, we were able to come through that pretty cleanly, because we weren't, got shut off and we were able to switch easily.
And you're able to switch your fired HRSG as well.
Yes.
So really it's almost like you're doing a sort of a service to the community by unloading, you know, your peak from the rest of the system. So yeah, that makes some sense. I imagine that was a pretty expensive option back when you bought the thing to make it all dual fuel. Or is it simply what I'm thinking?
It's you know, it's an extra fuel train, right? It's obviously the work associated with it. As far as the turbine goes, there's three other turbines like this from GE with this package that are out there. And we got number four.
Yeah, so we have two. We have one backup. We have one, and then we have a backup turbine.
Yeah.
Okay. And
for maintenance swaps. And then so that part was certainly new, right? It's a new package from the vendor.
Yeah.
And then the Hersig burners, it's certainly not the norm, right? Most areas they're for gas. They don't run backup. They don't run out of gas, right? In the local distribution, or there might be on the pipeline, right? So So this is kind of a, you know, where we are, probably our climate, probably the way that our regulatory system works here in Minnesota. We really don't have an option other than have a backup fuel.
Cool. So from,
I'm sure GE charges extra for it. I couldn't tell you exactly how much, but I can tell you that working with them, you don't get anything for free from them.
Yeah, it was probably in the 7+.
But you're really able to make this argument about how this helps resilience. I mean, yeah, the whole polar vortex, the whole area is in deep trouble, and you're able to help the situation out.
I mean, there's utilities retrofitting their gas turbines to be able to run dual fuel now in the state from that event that the PUC's just approved. And then there's, you know, the other thing that's come up that's unanticipated is we actually had our the major city water main break on the other side of town.
Okay.
But it was part of the main distribution system, so they decided to proactively curtail us just because they were scared of, you know, the high pressure gas main rupturing, right? So all kinds of aging infrastructure things go on that can you know, affect you that aren't even on campus. That we've already run into just operating this facility a few years now. So
Have you ever actually islanded where you're disconnected from power and you're running the whole place on your, is that a thing?
We have not. And again, we don't have the electrical capacity to fully island. And we haven't tried. It would be a challenge for, would be a challenge with our electrical distribution to, we could do a large part of campus, but not all of campus.
Right. So, yeah, that makes sense.
We do have a bit of a microgrid here, right, that our electric system has upgraded with automatic, you know, switching breakers and things like that, that'll load shed in that event, right? So you know, if we have a disturbance to lose the utility, theoretically, right, we keep that online without having to restart. It's, you know, unintentionally happened, I think, once or twice.
But it's not tested. Like you have critical loads on a critical bus that the turbine serves, or it's more of an ad hoc kind of setup.
Well, I mean, it's more than ad hoc. I mean, certainly there's a great deal of thought put into the grid and how, you know, where, what goes first if we go. But as far as, you know, just saying, all right, we're going to isolate campus today, that would be, that would take a little bit more thought, and hopefully out of our new energy and utility plan, we'll come up with another plan on the other end of campus, and then that'll be a possibility.
Sure, right. So, well, one other thing I think I picked up on the interview we had a while ago was the inlet air cooling aspect of this, which isn't something we find. I think this is the only of the 40 sites that told us about that. What I recall is that inlet air cooling somehow buys you close to 3 megs of peaking power. Is that, am I right about that?
Yeah, 2-3. I mean, it really depends upon how well the turbine is tuned at that hot condition. Yeah. You know, until the last couple of years here, you know, we only have a dozen 90 plus degree days. You know, it'd be humid, but it wouldn't be, you know, 90 plus. We've had a couple years of drought here, so we've had like 33 90 plus degree days, which is a lot for Minneapolis this last summer. So I mean, the inlet cooling, obviously, with a gas turbine has a, you know, the temperature has a huge impact of how much power you can make, and therefore how much cycle efficiency you have versus, you know, buying utility power or using other energy sources. So it does really allow us to maximize that, you know, the net benefit of spending a little bit of, you know, chiller energy versus what we get back. It's a, you know, it's like a 4-to-1 ratio on average. Yeah. So, it has a huge impact to our stability. And, you know, the way we've sized our system and how peaky we are in the summer versus how low it can get here, you know, in the holiday break season. You know, one thing I don't know how much we anticipated, but it has come up financially now is, you know, we're getting into a pretty significant ratchet now, where before we wouldn't hit that 50% ratchet rate, right, for cost recovery. And so it allows us to reduce that peak because, you know, when you ask campus, what's critical and what can we curtail on a hot day? Well, everything's critical. Nothing can get curtailed. And we did a, you know, we did a little analysis and we said, well, geez, 15% of this load on the main campus that is actually like a classroom building or an office, the rest is all outside air, right? And I mean, there's just nothing we can do there other than, you know, kicking people out of labs or something. So it's, you know, it has a huge impact just because of the sizing, the impact, and of course the financials you can feel in the wintertime if you're not watching your energy profile.
Yeah, right. So something like thermal energy storage, big storage tank, maybe wouldn't make that much sense because although your peak cooling is really high and maybe getting higher, it doesn't last very long, right? Am I right about that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, when we get into those hot, humid, 80-plus degree wet bulb kind of days, they're usually 3 or 4 days at a time, and they don't break during the night. And that's the big problem we have is our load doesn't break all that much during the night on most campus. And so there's certainly opportunity there. And I think there's a lot of, you know, potential there, especially as we look at energy savings on the demand side and what we can do there that would actually support demand shifting and peak reductions. But it's one of those things where, you know, I think this plan that we're going to about to embark on, we see a lot of opportunity on the demand side to really shape that profile more and then complement, you know, maybe smarter ways to, you know, support campus growth or load changes or retirements on the utility side.
Right. Well, yeah, before we get there, so talk just real briefly about your CFB unit and the extent to which you're able to use biomass.
Well, we don't really use biomass anymore in it. You know, so that unit, it's a Foster Mueller unit, was put in with the intent of being able to, you know, use biomass, coal fire, and we did do that for a number of years. The supply chain is the issue, right? We don't have dedicated supply chain folks. We've got we have two power systems in town that suck up a lot of that fuel. One in a downtown and the other one, outside, making power. And so the supply chain and the cost just unfortunately without dedicated resources, right? It's tough. But we've been doing it a number of years. Was basically modeled after a kind of a European cogen setup. It's a very efficient boiler, can do a lot of different things, but you know, there's a lot of potential there, but that's just the reality of that and $3 gas, you know? So.
Yeah. And I think one of the things we heard across the country was this problem with supply. It's all good, except you just can't lock in a steady source of good quality fuel,
right?
And so you know it's a big challenge to you know, to be able to justify it, whereas a gas cogen system like you got has really proven to be cost effective. Well cool. So yeah, let's talk a little about the demand side here. Hundreds of buildings, I suppose, and many of them that date back a decade. I mean, probably a lot of opportunity for energy efficiency.
Yeah, I think we're 280 buildings, everything from the late 1800s to, you know, things that were just built or just in the process of being built. So a wide range of systems and capabilities. But it's been a focus for quite a while for campus. And you know, not only energy reduction, I know we've reduced the thing since 2010. I think our, you know, average energy EUI on campus is down about 25% to 30%. Our carbon reduction, I mean, now CHP helped that considerably, but we're down 50% from our 28 or 29 baseline. So yeah, we've been making some big efforts there as best we can. And as we move now, like I said, we just came out with a new climate action plan with some really aggressive goals, and we'll be moving in that direction, you know, even faster at this point.
What another one of the things I kind of picked up on was you got a really sophisticated control system, and there's a lot of effort and energy been put into kind of tuning that up. Is that a big part of your energy savings, or are there, more air handler replacements and system retrofits, or what's sort
No,
of the how do you approach it?
I think they go hand in hand. I think controls is a again, I can't take any credit. We've had some really proactive people that have been here and built a system, a really smart, well thought out system. It's it's all open, non-proprietary, open protocol, BACnet, so it's a huge system. It's our system guy is routinely tells us, the largest in North America, if not, a bigger area than that. So many millions of points and controls and yeah, it's we've got a very, very robust system that we actively work not only, to keep updated, but also to work whatever we can for scheduling and programming to work our conservation.
And I would imagine there's fault detection and sort of automated ways to optimize energy, not only plant energy, but energy being used in the buildings. One idea that a lot of the universities we talked to kind of brought up was the idea of coupling decarbonization with addressing deferred maintenance. And I'm just wondering, is that something that's in your heads? How, the fact that you got a lot of really old buildings with really old systems, and boy, if we could just improve those systems, we could get the added benefit of a lot more efficiency and decarbonization.
Well, certainly, and as and I think everybody that you talk to will say the same thing. We've got these very aggressive carbon goals, which fundamentally change kind of how we look at, how are we going to heat campus, how are we going to cool campus. If many people would have us, get out of the burning anything phase, and we got to, which I think we all understand the challenges of that, but even just switching from a steam-based system to a hot water system, on a campus this size would be, the dollars involved, or many zeros that, many more zeros than most people are willing to even think about spending. So yes, we look at, infrastructure renewal. Any opportunity that we've got for renovations or new building construction, any of that stuff where we can, influence that in some sort of way to be more energy conserve, conserve more energy, be more energy efficient. Now I will tell you, we don't always win those battles, and we probably lose more than we win. But as we move forward, like I said, the campus has signed up to meet some pretty aggressive goals, and I think people are just starting to realize what that means. As people in the administration, okay, if that's what we're really going to do, then we're really going to have to change the way we're doing things.
And they realize that the utility system is really the primary carbon emitter on campus here. And if you want to make any difference at all in decarbonization, you really got to address it from the standpoint of utilities.
You do. Yeah, there's no question about it.
I think right. And then the many zeros, or maybe another way to say the B that's in the front of the zeros.
Yes.
It's a very daunting thing. Everywhere, it's a very daunting thing,
Yes.
and doesn't seem like it's always that easy to communicate that with faculty and staff. It's just not an easy thing unless somebody's willing to make some huge financial commitments.
Well, it's the challenges that, we don't, yes, they're huge financial, and commitments. We keep saying, we're talking billions, not millions. And, yeah. And we're also talking that we don't want to, we can't close down campus. We can't shut down buildings. We can't, so we've got, we can't turn off, but we can't challenge, it'd be a lot easier if we say, all right, we've got some, here's the 350, 1,000 square foot building. All right, everybody out for the next year and a half. And then we'll gut it and we'll redo it. That'd be a lot cheaper. Sure. And we could do some really good things there, but nobody's willing to kick people out of buildings. Well, we get it done, but it's one of the challenges of trying to do things. So you're trying to do things while you're maintaining the old systems while you build new systems.
Sure. But yeah. Fixing the plane while you're flying it.
Exactly.
Let me just move on to the other thing that I think we picked up here as we were going through our notes was the, we talked a little about building automation and control. That's a very impressive group, but your group as a whole, your whole technical staff here, struck us as being, kind of top drawer. And organized in a little bit different way. Could you just talk briefly about, how you manage the engineering and operation end of such a huge campus with three plants and that sort of thing?
I think I've been with the university now for just over 10 years. So I was assistant director, on the energy conservation side, on the demand side. And so just a year and a half ago, well, you guys knew Jerome and then Eric Van Meter. So when Eric retired, I was fortunate enough to be able to move up into this position. So a lot of our structure has been built by those two guys before. And as you said, it's a unique, I think unique to many of the campuses, but we have a group that is, Jim is in charge of, assistant director for utility operations. So we have a group of, basically trades that, it's the day-to-day, keep the campus running, keep the maintenance going, keep everything, keep the campus going. That's, keep the lights on, keep the heat on, keep the cooling on. That's that group. And then we have, a small electrical engineering group, a mechanical engineering group. We've got a civil group, and then we've got a building automation group. And then we've got the demand side where we have district engineers out in our districts, and they'll be responsible for, we have five districts, call it 1/5 of the buildings. And their job is to go out and find any demand reductions they can find. And then we'll try to fund whatever conservation efforts we have. But, we all kind of work together. The demand, the mechanical, as Scott said, and we work very closely. The mechanical and the electrical work very closely together. And with operations, for example, peak shaving in the summer. It looks like it's going to be a really hot day. Our electrical client will call Scott or Jim, and they'll say, okay, well, we'll fire up all the absorption chillers and reduce our electric chillers and try to reduce our demand that way. Or if in the winter, we need more electrical use, we'll flip it around and, so we don't have to cycle the plant. I think it's, you got a lot of smart people. We have a lot of smart people. Yeah. That have helped build the system. A lot of them have been here, like Scott, have been here for a long time. They understand the systems. They understand them very well. We work closely with whatever capital projects come along. We get involved heavily to make sure that, hey, we're not reinventing the wheel, or we're not, we've learned many lessons along the way. We'd like to impart as many of those as we can.
Yeah.
So that we don't have to go ultimately diagnose and fix them down the road.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and then when they do sneak by, we've got people to go fix them.
Yeah. So it's really the sort of mutual collaboration. It's a little more of a horizontal kind of not siloed
Yeah, I would say very much a matrix horizontal organization. It's very much so.
And the building side, that's really they're closely coupled to the plant side, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, we track demand reduction, and they'll say, we have a lot of we're constantly adding buildings to our central chill water loop, and they'll get involved with that. And then we have process, out in the labs, we'll have process work, and say, hey, they've got six little chillers in here for the various processes. Well, let's consolidate, put them on the loop, and we'll take those systems offline. And so yeah, they get involved very closely with the rest of the group. Electrical, same thing. Can we do this better? Can lots of campuses converted virtually. Well, I think we're what about 75 or 80% to LED at this point. So we're doing constantly working on something. Lots of buildings to do.
I'll bet. So when you have an organization like this, how do you set the key performance indicators and hold yourselves accountable for performance? What is there a it's just a collaborative kind of thing, or is there some directive from the top that says we got to do better on EUI or kW per ton or something?
Well, it's I would say a little bit of both. I mean, up until now, up until recently, we had a carbon reduction goal and a EUI reduction goal, and the goal at that point was, well, to achieve 50% carbon reduction by 2022. Was it 2022 or 2020 something? Anyway, so from the 2009 baseline, we had a goal to reduce carbon by 50% in by 2022. And so, part of that was, most almost all of that was on the demand side. The CHP, where we were able to, stop using some coal, helped, was a big chunk of that. But then the rest of it, more than probably, I think it was 13% was CHP, and the rest was all done by demand reduction. And so we met that goal, continue working, kind of as our along the same lines. We just have a new climate action plan that came out that has, now we have by 2033, we have to reduce the demand side by another 35%. And that's it. And then we have to reduce the supply side as well. And so we'll be working, coming up with plans to figure out how we get to those goals. So those are the top down. And then I would say from the internal, it's more just a lot of dedicated people that want to make things right.
Well, that's really impressive. And I wish you luck.
Thank you. We're gonna need it.
Yeah, well, that covered, I think, the questions I laid out here. Is there anything you'd like to just talk about that, reasons that you guys are successful or things you'd like to share with other institutions?
Well, I think the one thing, talking through projects and all that is, we just continue to keep looking at things because things change all the time, right? Whether it's, what the supplies are, what the technology is, what the solutions are, right? I mean, we basically built two different types of CHP systems in 15 years, right? With different, outcomes, right? And I anticipate across the industry, we're going to see that more and more, right? So, yeah, I mean, I'm very excited about a lot of the new technologies that are just emerging out there, right? Because maybe they'll, help us. There's a huge market that's worldwide, right? That's out there untapped, and so yeah, I think I'm excited to see what comes down the road the next couple of years here, because it goes beyond just fundamentals, right? Like CHP, well, this is as good as I can make it, right? Well, new technology will change that, and if it's something we can adapt to our campuses, and make sense across the board, right? I think there's just an incredible amount of opportunity there. So keeps it exciting.
I think that's one of the real advantages to district energy, kind of writ large, is its adaptability. You're able to roll with different market factors and policy and regulation and, global problems. So you go from being CFB at 1 year, that making some sense, and now it's CHP, that makes some sense. And next, who knows what it is, but you'll be able to adapt it into your system somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Whether we, heat recovery on a large scale, whether we, geothermal or, what's Cornell drilling down to the center of the earth and figure out how to warm everything at once, we get that going, and all we got to do is plug it into the system, right?
Yeah, all you got to do.
That's all we got to do.
Cool. Well, Scott or Sarah, do you have any other, have I missed anything here we should touch on? Very good.
Well, great.
Yeah. Thanks again for your time and your, for giving. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks, guys.